Hello, and welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. We release these episodes every week on Wednesday mornings, and the best way to support us is by clicking subscribe and taking a moment to rate the podcast wherever you are listening. If you'd like to support our efforts to keep the nonprofit Meditation Center open in Nashville, you can donate via Venmo by sending your donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can make a donation through our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, by clicking the Donate tab. Peace and love. Hope you enjoy.
So we'll go ahead and jump in today to the topic. This morning I'm going to speak on the second noble truth, craving, clinging, reactivity, the realm of the hungry ghost, which we'll talk about here in a little bit. If you're just joining us, my friend and I share responsibilities for teaching the Sunday morning group. We alternate every other Sunday. And since we've opened back up, we've decided to do series of talks on different topics. And in our lineage of Buddhism, which kind of draws on the Theravadan tradition, the old school Buddhists, there are a lot of different lists, which makes it really helpful as a teacher because you kind of have a curriculum, you know? And our curriculum for the next several weeks is the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. I think it's a great thing to focus on. It is central to every form of Buddhism, actually. Every school, Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, all have the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path as the core. And so I thought it might be nice to talk a little bit about, just a very little bit about how the Buddha arrived at this teaching. This was called his first teaching. It's in a sutta called the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which is the longest word I think I know. It's all one word. And it's said that it was his first teaching ever given. Throughout the Buddha's life, he grew up in a relative level of wealth and luxury. We maybe kind of think that he wasn't probably a prince. In the region that they say that he lived in, there weren't really kingdoms, but there were kind of feudal properties where there would be landowners and non-landowners, right? And so his dad was a landowner. And so he was born into kind of a upper class, and I think he would travel into the village and see other people living in different circumstances, and this kind of shook him at his core. You know, he started to see, you know, well, we may be all born and be born into different positions and different conditions, but we still all age, get sick, and die. And so what is really going to bring out a meaningful life? What is really meaningful in this lifetime? And so he left home and said, you know, this has become my goal, and the aim of my life is to figure out how to live a meaningful life and how to uproot suffering. And the first thing he did is he got a couple good mentors. And he found some meditators, and they taught him this practice, actually, of focused, single-pointedness attention on a single object, like the breath meditation. So that's not unique to the Buddha's teaching. It's called samadhi, or concentration practice. And they taught him this. And he mastered it. He was really great at ignoring his mind. He sat down in meditation, focused on his breath. He absorbed his attention into his breath so much that all of these blissful states and tranquility would develop, but then he would get up off the meditation cushion and the mind would come back. And so he said, well, I've mastered this ability to ignore my mind, but I still have to deal with my mind when I'm not meditating. So he thanked his teachers and went along with his life, and the next thing he decided was, you know, growing up in a tremendous amount of privilege with all the material pleasure, sense pleasures, and status, and security, and belonging that I ever wanted was not making me happy. So the problem, the spiritual malady, the spiritual affliction must be pleasure. And so he joined these ascetics and these people that basically tried to limit to an extreme degree the amount of pleasure that they experience. And they would starve themselves and stand on one leg and hang themselves by their balls by a tree. True story. And all in this view that pleasure was the problem. You know, if you could root out your mind desiring pleasure, then somehow you would be free from suffering by denying your body it, right? And so this, of course, didn't work. He almost died, and I'd say the second guide on his path appeared, a farmer's daughter named Sujata. She found him and came and fed him, probably a lot more wise than the Buddha at the time. Hey, you're going to die if you don't eat, so here's some food. He begrudgingly took it, accepted it, and let himself come to a place of health. And then he reflected and said, well, pleasure, I thought, was the problem. You know, I grew up with a life of luxury, and at first I thought it was the solution, because that's what I was raised in. If you just get enough success and enough pleasure and enough material things, you'll be happy. I wasn't happy there. That didn't work. And then I thought, I have to deny myself pleasure. So we went to this other extreme. If I deny myself nutriment and the pleasures of the world, then I'll be happy. And that didn't work either. So he was kind of shit out of luck, right? And you may have heard the Buddha arrived at a middle path between two extremes. And I'd say these two extremes are of craving and clinging to pleasure as the source of your happiness, and hatred and aversion to pain. And neither work. So what do? So he sat under the Bodhi tree and he observed his mind, and he saw that it wasn't pleasure or pain that was the problem. It was actually the mind's relationship to pleasure and pain. When the mind told him that his happiness was in that next thing, that it was not fulfilling its promise. And that when his mind told him if he could just not feel pain and not experience discomfort, then he would be happy, he realized that that was the problem too. That happiness really comes from being with pleasure and pain, and not attaching to pleasure, but enjoying pleasure when it's present. Not craving after pleasure. You know, but sure, we have desires and goals and things, but how fixated are we on our desires and goals to make us happy, ultimately? And not hating pain, not resisting pain, not avoiding pain, but actually embracing it and practicing compassion, softening around it and saying, oh, this is painful. Right now it's like this. I feel this. I care for this. And so he had this experience. It's hard to give words to, right? That's about the best we can do. And he rooted out this reactivity in his mind. Pleasure and pain didn't go away, but the reactivity of his mind towards it, they say, completely went away, was uprooted. And he thought, well, how am I going to teach this? And do I want to teach this? He actually has a moment of kind of a crisis after his enlightenment where he's like, if I even tried, it would be a pain in the ass, because it's a lot of work to investigate your mind and to see when it's clinging and craving for pleasure and trying to avoid pain, because it's basically all that this thing does. But then he says, well, it's the generous, it's the compassionate thing to do, so of course I'll give it a try. And the first time he tried, someone crossed his path on the road and they said, you look radiant and luminous and at peace. What's your teaching? Instead of telling this person what his teaching was, how he arrived at that, he told them instead, as we do a lot of times with religions, he talked more about his status, which is, he said, I am the Tathagata, I'm the enlightened one. And the person was like, okay, yeah, whatever, dude, see you later, right? And this is the problem we get in with religions a lot of the time, is we talk about the ideal of perfection, and we don't talk about the process, right? That this is actually a contemplative practice, a process that the Buddha went through. So I think my projection is that he learned that, and he said, I have to actually teach a practice not a proclamation, a doctrine. So then he sat in front of his friends. He went back to his ascetics. And he said, well, they're really hardcore. They don't have this thing right, but they're dedicated, that's for sure. And maybe they'll listen. So he went and he taught them the Four Noble Truths. I'm not going to go through the sutta, but I want to highlight what he said in the Four Noble Truths. And the first thing he said is that life is inherently vulnerable. That in life, there's both pleasure and pain. And that because of the way that this experience is for humans, pleasure and pain are impermanent. We don't always get what we want. Sometimes we get what we don't want. Sometimes we gain things. Sometimes we lose things. Sometimes we are connected in our relationships. Sometimes we're disconnected. You know, he says basically life is inherently vulnerable. The Chinese Buddhists say life is equally 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. And he kind of says this to, I believe, to normalize it. Have you noticed that life is hard sometimes? That you don't have a ton of control over what happens. The body ages, we grow old, we will pass away. Our current set of conditions will change. And he says, instead of making this a capital T truth, he creates it as a task to be practiced. Because he learned, I think, from his mistake. He said, so I'm not just telling you life is full of pleasure and pain and everything's impermanent. He said, I'm actually asking you to practice embracing that fact, radically accepting life as it is. He said, but it's hard, the second noble truth, because life is impermanent, because life is vulnerable, inconstant, subject to change. He says, we become reactive. We want it to be pleasurable. We want to gain things and to have status and to have pleasurable experiences. And we don't want to have the discomfort, the grief, the loss, the pain. We don't want that. He said it's actually trying to get things to be different than the way that you want them to be that causes your suffering. He said life itself is not a problem. It's the wanting it to be different that's the problem. And he gives us a task. He says, if we can embrace the pleasure-pain dichotomy of life, the ebb and flow of life, as it occurs, we don't have to act on the reactivity towards it. We can let go of fighting against it. And as we let go of fighting against life, we actually experience a deeper, more authentic happiness because our happiness is no longer dependent upon getting things to be a certain way. Happiness becomes about being able to be with things as they are. That's hard to do, right? You could see why he probably was like, I don't know if I'm going to teach this. And he says the third task is to actually to gain confidence in that experience, that when we don't fight or resist or try to control life to be a certain way, we actually experience more joy. More a deeper happiness that looks something more like peace rather than acquisition, rather than possession, rather than status, even rather than validation, because the validation's even temporary, right? One day they like you, one day they hate you. He says it's a deeper happiness and that we want to build confidence in letting go of reactivity and learning to live in the flow of life. And that when things are hard, we learn to have compassion. And to say, yeah, it hurts. Not to practice spiritual bypassing. Like, oh, if I'm a practicing Buddhist, then when things are hard, I accept it. Like as if acceptance is somehow avoidance. But acceptance means actually coming into the experience with an open heart, compassion, opening up to the discomfort and the pain. Ah, I feel this. I care for this. I feel my grief. I feel my sadness. This sadness, this grief, this unpleasantness. and feeling self-liberate. This is another big insight the Buddha had, is that unpleasant changes. The good news of impermanence when things are really hard is that it's not always going to be this way. But the bad news of impermanence is when things are really good, it's not always going to be this way. So we can't let our happiness be dependent on having it always be this way or that way. So we want to build confidence in that. And we want to practice. We need to practice radical acceptance. We need to practice cultivating a type of happiness that is not born of conditions. And the Buddha says there are two levels to this, which we'll get into in a couple weeks on the path factor of wise view. But one level is seeing that no matter how much we want this experience to be different, it's not going to be. So however much I want to not age and not grow old and not die and not get sick, it's never going to be that way. That it's as natural as the air we breathe. Aging is natural. Sickness is natural. Death is natural. He says this is the ultimate view. He says the relative view is that that's hard to accept, so we need to cultivate a gentle, ethical way of being in these conditions. We need to cultivate kindness and compassion and gratitude and equanimity and generosity and wise friendship. These are included in the Eightfold Path, right? So this is the fourth task. The first is embrace the nature of reality. Pleasure and pain exist. Impermanence exists. The second is to let go of our reactivity of trying to fight against it, to come into that experience. As we start to let go of fighting against it, we experience a deeper happiness, and we have to cultivate a practice that lives in line with that reality, right? The Four Noble Truths. Embrace, let go, see, act. Elsa. Let it go. So the first thing I want to do is to normalize that this isn't easy. Right? The nervous system is designed to favor pleasure and to want to avoid pain. And even the Buddha acknowledged that craving and reactivity and clinging, trying to control and resist against life, he says, you know, it's really hard. And he says actually two things about craving and reactivity. He says one is, it arises. That's all that he says about craving. It arises. So what he says is that you can't stop your nervous system from wanting things to be pleasant and hating pain. That's just what it does. He says, but you don't have to follow that impulse all the time. Right, so we don't get to choose the first arrow, which is unpleasant, don't like, want it to be different. But we get to remove the second arrow of I'm going to fight and argue and resent and blame and control and all of these things my way through this. So craving arises. We can't stop it from arising. And he also says that it's repetitive. It will keep arising. It will keep arising and arising and arising and arising and arising until we let it come and go, let it come and go, let it come and go, let it come and go. Don't react, let it come and go. Handle it skillfully, handle it ethically. Let it come and go until it doesn't come and go anymore. Maybe this lifetime, maybe next lifetime, maybe this moment, maybe next moment. In recovery world, they say don't give up 5 minutes before the miracle happens. So it could always be the next breath. So I like to think of this craving and reactivity like a conveyor belt. It's like a ski lift, right? But you're not the operator of the ski lift. All of the evolutionary biology of our ancestors is the operator of the ski lift. Your past karma, how much you've acted on your reactivity is the ski lift. You know, the Buddha says, whatever you practice, he says, whatever you practice, you get better at. Whatever you think and ponder upon becomes the inclination of your mind. So if you keep feeding the worry and the fear and the resentment and the anger, you know, it's like building momentum. The conveyor belt's going a little faster each time we engage with it. He says it's not your fault that it arises, but when you engage with it, he says it's not your fault that it arises, but it's your responsibility to not engage with it. Because each time you engage with it, you perpetuate it. So I like to think of karma as like a conveyor belt, and craving and reactivity is like a conveyor belt, a ski lift. And all we're being asked to do is to just not grab hold of the rope. You can't stop it from spinning through the mind. Person cuts you off, spinning through the mind. You know, I don't want to be in the cubicle with this person, spinning through the mind. You know, reaching for the simple short-term pleasure, just not grasping. Mindfulness helps us to see the craving or reactivity arise and let it come and go without getting involved. That, did you notice that when you practice mindfulness? You step back and watch it. You just watch it happen without getting involved. That's why they say in secular mindfulness worlds, mindfulness is a non-judgmental awareness. I would say mindfulness is a discerning awareness, but not taking the conveyor belt personally, not identifying with your mind as yourself. If you could stop your mind, you would do it, but you can't. So you relate to your mind differently. You see it, don't take the bait all the time, you redirect your attention to something more skillful. You know, like Buddha did with the Mara, the visiting demon, which is just a kind of symbol of his own mind, his own reactivity. He didn't fight Mara with more Mara, more reactivity. He just said, I see you, Mara. That's all throughout the discourses, is the Buddha would just say, I see you. Discernment, not taking the bait. So mindfulness just helps us to see it arise and let it come and go without getting involved. And simply redirecting our attention away from the thought stream to something more skillful, to something more helpful, something more useful. So then we generate this other conveyor belt on the other side. Right? There's the rickety ski lift that's all rusty that you're going to get tetanus from. And then there's the one we're cultivating over here that's redirecting ourselves away from the resentment, away from the, you know, greed and the hatred and the delusion into something more skillful, more helpful. And I like that because in Buddhism, we don't talk about sinfulness and righteousness. We talk about skillfulness and unskillfulness, what's constructive and what's destructive. You can't write a book about that. You got to live that. You got to see for yourself what's skillful. And what is skillful? The Buddha defines, he says, what leads to your welfare and happiness and the welfare and happiness of others? That would be such an interesting reflection if throughout my day, before everything I thought, I spoke, and I did, I reflected and said, does this thought lead to my welfare and happiness and the welfare and happiness of others? Is what I'm going to say lead to my welfare and happiness and the welfare and happiness of others? Is what I'm about to do? You know, the neuroscientist Melvin Konner, many of y'all are familiar, I always quote him during this talk because I find it incredibly validating that he researched, he studied the default mode network of the human brain, which is when you're not engaged in a task, when you're, you know, just on default, autopilot, the brain is a vague mixture of anxiety and desire, he says, best described by the phrase, I want, spoken with or without an object for the verb. What that means is that we don't even know what we want. There's just this restless feeling of wanting something. Have you ever noticed that feeling? I just like the word restlessness. There's this, you know, this, and then in Buddhism, they call it tanha, which is thirst. I like that word, thirst. The Buddha says that the problem with that is that it's unquenchable. You get something temporarily, but then you have to keep it up. And we're going to talk about that. So our evolutionary biology has come to equate comfort and pleasure with safety. Right? Like our ancestors, and we don't want to get into the habit of viewing certain foods as good or bad either, right? We've got to understand that our evolutionary history is that high-calorie, high-sugared foods bring energy. So our brain's selected for it. This is what's going to keep me alive. And we came to equate these chemicals in our brain, dopamine, norepinephrine, some of y'all may know this stuff better than I do, you know, these chemicals, these receptors in our brain, with security. So the brain says, when I feel good, I'm safe. The problem with that, of course, is that we're not wired to be happy, we're wired to survive. We also prioritized belonging because especially the human species, our survival depended upon getting along with the tribe. If they left you behind, you weren't going to live, right? So am I attractive enough? Am I worthy? Do people value me? So we have to realize that investigating craving and clinging is not so much about the behavior, you know, that this person has a lot of money, and so we just say, oh, that person must experience a lot of greed or craving or attachment, you know, or that, you know, this person likes to, you know, do this thing or do that thing. We don't want to get caught in the outside appearance. We actually have to look inside. What is the mind state that underlies our behavior? And here's the last thing. Each one of us is responsible for investigating that ourselves. So I can talk all day long, and I'm a social worker, so I'm all about engaged Buddhism. I'm all about engaging with systems of oppression and fighting against, you know, macro greed and oppression. I'm all about that. The only thing I ultimately have control over is what this mind does, though. I have to be really careful about this mind. Yeah, so it's a both and for me. We got to look inside and see what is the mind doing underneath. And we have to be honest. How much of our daily experience is driven by seeking comfort and pleasure in things outside of ourselves? A lot. So what I'm trying to say here is it's not your fault. It's just kind of how it is. We all struggle with that. But one of the things that's helpful is to distinguish the difference between desire and craving. In the Abhidhamma, which is the text on Buddhist psychology, they got really nerdy and they broke down different mind states into categories. And they said, desire by itself, just having desire, is an ethically variable mental factor. I said very nerdy, right? So what does that mean? It means desire in and of itself can go any direction. Having goals and aspirations are actually important parts of our lives. Having a desire to practice, to live a spiritual life, is a wholesome desire, a skillful desire. In Buddhism, they actually call this chanda, this wholesome desire, which is an eagerness to commit and apply oneself to a goal. And I want to read this. This is actually a really good book if you want to explore the Four Noble Truths a little bit more by Ajahn Sucitto. It's called Turning the Wheel of Truth. And this is what he says about the difference between desire and craving. He says, desire, that is an eagerness to offer or to commit or to apply yourself to a goal, such as awakening or meditation or living in line with spiritual principles, is called chanda. It's a psychological yes. It's a choice, not a pathology. In fact, you could summarize the Dharma, the Buddha's teaching and training, as the transformation of tanha, which is craving and thirst, into chanda. It's a process where we guide our voluntary actions and intentions and thoughts. We grab and hold on to the steering wheel and travel with clarity towards our deeper well-being. So we're not trying to get rid of desire, which would just be another type of desire. Instead, we're trying to transfer, transmute our desire, to take it out of the shadow of gratification and need and use its aspiration and vigor to bring us into light and clarity. However, tanha, meaning thirst or craving, is not a chosen kind of desire, it's a reflex. It's the desire to pull something in and feed on it. It's the desire that's never satisfied because it just shifts from one sense to another, from one emotional need to the next, from one sense of achievement to another goal. It's the desire that comes from a black hole of need, however small and manageable that need is. Tanha is not a choice, it's a reflex. It's demanding the satisfaction of our desire. It's where desire becomes impulsive. It's where we become reactive. We talk about two types of thirst. There's craving and then there's clinging. I want to talk just a moment about clinging. It's a little bit different flavor. You know, this is a sad story. It's not morbid, but it's sad, as many of these ancient stories are. But there are these monkey traps in India. And let's just say they just trap the monkeys and take them out to the jungle, all right? They might, I don't know, but they need to trap monkeys for some reason. And what they do for these traps is they actually don't use snares, and they don't use poison, and they don't use tranquilizers. What they do is they bury a clay pot in the ground, and they put a piece of food in it. And the food is big enough, or the hole in the clay pot is big enough to fit your hand through when it's open, but not big enough to fit your hand through when it's closed. And monkeys will come along and they'll put their hand down in the hole and grab onto the food, and they will get their hand stuck. And they won't let go of the food. If they did, they could free themselves, but they get trapped. Until the person comes along and sees that the monkey is there with their hand stuck in the clay pot, and I guess they dig up the clay pot and take the monkey with them. You know, clinging is often about control. It's about resisting change. It's the illusion that we have any influence, ultimately, over the pleasure and pain that we experience. We do have some agency, sure, but that agency is only ever temporary. And clinging is about holding on to an identity, holding on to a position, holding on to a relationship that's not serving us anymore, holding on to an experience, the last day of vacation, holding on to a high for an addict, one more. The better strategy is to learn to be at ease with letting go, to embracing that, the temporariness of the experience, to practice a non-attached appreciation, holding things with an open fist, an open hand. You know, I think about it like kids at show and tell. Everyone's passing along their thing, and you can enjoy it, you can delight in it, but it's got to go. It's not yours. It's not coming home with you. My daughter's 2, and she doesn't like to share. She just doesn't like it. Everything right now for her is mine. Even things that aren't hers are mine. When she's playing with other kids, she'll say, mine, mine. I'm like, that's not yours, that's theirs, right? And even at that level, right, so impersonal, we're just kind of born with that. That struggle to let things go. So there are three types of craving. Just want to kind of go over these real quick that the Buddha talks about and highlights. And the first is called kama tanha, K-A-M-M-A tanha, which is thirst. So it's a kind of thirst, and it's the thirst for sense pleasure. The way that Ajahn Sachido calls it that I like is he calls it sensory input. Because I've found, interestingly, as a therapist, that it's not always pleasure that we're seeking. We're just seeking something to change how we feel, right? And it may not even be pleasure that changes how we feel. It may be pain, it may be dysfunction or chaos or drama or, you know, whatever it may be. I'm guilty of all of these at some level. So, craving for sense input. In Buddhist cosmology, I really like the mythology and cosmology in Buddhism. You know, in some senses, I feel like as I continue to practice, and the word in the Buddhist canon for faith, for how we develop faith, is something called ehipasiko, which is we do it through experience. So as I experience more and more benefits through the practice, I come to actually, my view is that things like reincarnate or rebirth, you know, things like this are, you know, for in my experience, probably real. You don't have to believe that, though. But below that level of whether it's real or not is the psychological rebirth of how we get born into different places. You know, moment to moment on one day. A teacher named John Peacock went into his Tibetan master one day and he said, "You mean to tell me that there are these realms of existence that I've been traveling through for thousands and thousands of births?" And he said, "No, you idiot, that's your mind on one day." So that's the level we're practicing with. That's the practical level. And one of these realms is, let's see if I can name them. Don could probably help me out. There's the hell realm. There's the animal realm. There's the realm of the hungry ghosts. And these go kind of in levels. Hell realm, animal realm, realm of the hungry ghosts, the human realm. There's the jealous god realm. And then there's the heaven realm. I think that's it. Did I miss one? I think that's it. Six realms.
Depends on which formulation.
Yeah, it depends on what school. And there, in the realm of the hungry ghost, it's actually the realm of addiction. It's the realm of kama tanha, being stuck in the cycle of addictive patterns. And I've lived in this realm. And the realm is visualized, it has some imagery with it, of these creatures that have a very big body, that have a very skinny neck, and that have a pinhole mouth. And so they have this insatiable hunger that they can never quite fill. And so they're always, always, always craving. And the hardest thing about living within this realm, maybe some of us have had times where we've been in addiction, not just from drug and alcohol, but other patterns, addictive patterns. That we become so bound to the cycle, so dependent on it, that it becomes our master in a way. You know, we serve it in all that we do. It becomes what we live for. And it often becomes the solitary thing that brings us any relief. I always tell people that I believe from myself and my experience that drug and alcohol addiction saved me from suicidality. You know, I was so miserable and felt so trapped, and it was the one thing that gave me any relief when I was a teenager. Although it also became the sole thing, the main thing that was my main source of pain and misery in my life, too. So there's this paradox to it. And we really have to be diligent about investigating the mind's relationship to pleasure, you know, to sense input, you know, to our patterns. I've heard a psychologist say that the mind will seek what's familiar over what brings it happiness. So we will tend to, you know, go back into these patterns, to relapse into them, right? Because they do fulfill a need, but the need is only temporary. So we take short-term happiness, short-term pleasure over long-term happiness. And I think we have to be honest that that means if we're stepping out of a pattern or a cycle, there's going to be some suffering, some withdrawal, some dealing with feelings that we haven't dealt with in a while. And Ajahn Chah says that there are two types of suffering. There's the suffering of continuing on in the pattern and the suffering of getting out of it. Either way, it's hard. Right? And that's the something I talked about a little bit last time I spoke on that purgatory, that place of desperation. Damned if I do, damned if I don't. I can feel good now and prolong and perpetuate the pattern, or I could feel like shit now and maybe get to the other side. So craving for sense pleasure is very powerful. There's another type of craving called craving for existence, which I just want to talk about real briefly. Craving to become something or someone that you're not. I call it the craving of deficiency. It's a sense of lacking. If only I was better, smarter, more attractive. If only I got the promotion, then I would be happy. If only I lived somewhere else or did something else or was someone else, I'd be happy. Again, it's not a problem to have desires and goals and aspirations, but when we make our happiness about them and based in them, we can't be happy until we get them. And then the happiness we get from them is only temporary anyway. When I moved into my new neighborhood, I was going to be this friendly neighbor that was out and about and exercising more. And I moved in there and I was actually with the same mind, the same person. Go figure. So craving of this is called bhava tanha. Craving for existence is the if only X then Y, or the once I get, or the if onlys, or the I'd rather be's. I'd rather be somewhere else, someone else, doing something else. This is a big one. And the false promise of this is that somehow our existential loneliness will be satisfied by becoming some other version of ourselves, and it never pays out. Becoming that person that I think I'm not, one, I'll never be that person because it's the mind that's creating it in the first place, and second, if I get close, it won't satisfy the loneliness that I'm seeking for it to. Wherever you go, there you are, right? It also creates a sense of lacking. It steamrolls over the possibility of finding contentment in the present because it says that I need to get somewhere else or be somewhere else. We stop looking at the present. We dissociate from it when we're too caught up in the success and accomplishments and so on and so forth. The third and final is the opposite of this, vibhava tanha, which means craving for non-existence. If somehow I could not be in this body or be this version of myself or be this person, it's not so much a craving to be, it's a craving not to be. Shakespeare was right, to be or not to be, that is the question, right? And when we want to be or to not be, there's a lot of suffering because we ignore the I am. I am this right now. Or right now it's like this. Actually, I am not this. This is how it is. For me. Of course, in extremes, this can, you know, turn into depression, suicidality, things that I'm very familiar with. I like looking at it this way, and it's been helpful for some of my clients that have suicidality and to see it as just another defense mechanism. You know, it's a way to not want to be here. And I'm not so sure that that's true. I'm not so sure that there is a way out. I think there's a way through, and I think the Buddha taught that. I think a lot of spiritual traditions taught that. I think therapy helps with the way through. I think there's a lot of hope of getting through. I don't think we get out. What does the Buddha teach as the antidote to craving? He teaches Panya, Sila, Samadhi. These are the three pillars of the Eightfold Path. Panya is the wise view. We're born into the biological condition where the nervous system craves pleasure and hates pain. We embrace that we live in a world with both, the vulnerability of conditions changing. Through meditation and practicing principles, ethical values. We can stop perpetuating the reactive ways of navigating our vulnerable condition. We can let go of reactivity and rest into the wise relationship to pleasure and pain, to have a non-attached appreciation to pleasure and a compassionate relationship to pain. As we cultivate the capacity to let go of reactivity, we experience the freedom of living in harmony with things the way that they are. This is the third noble truth. And the fourth is, over time, we continue to cultivate a skillful way of relating to life on life's terms through the Eightfold Path. So this is the view. The practice, sila, is an ethical, value-oriented way to approach life. We cultivate the principles of kindness, of compassion, of gratitude, of equanimity, of generosity, of being of service. We renounce the reactivity, not because it's sinful, but because it doesn't lead to our welfare and happiness. It doesn't support and sustain that, a meaningful way of living in the world. And we investigate it, and we see it clearly, and we let it go. We stop acting reactively. And what helps us do that is the five precepts. This is the basis of ethics. And I'm not going to go into it, but we'll talk about it. The five precepts are a commitment to basically not cause harm. The third pillar is meditation, mind training of mindfulness. During practice, we see the impermanent and impersonal nature of reactivity arising in the mind. We see the mind say, plan, prepare, compare, judge, criticize. We see the mind full of craving and aversion, restlessness, lethargy, doubt, and we let those states arise and pass. And we don't perpetuate, we don't get involved. Just like the Buddha did with Mara, we say, I see you, Mara. We open our hearts and let things come and go, and we learn how to do that through meditation. So I go back to what the Buddha said. It's hard work. But we've got a sangha, we've got a community, we've got a practice. We've got each other to help encourage, to inspire, you know? And we've got a practice to take refuge in. And the thing that I like to say is, despite if you're new to Buddhism or not, it's not about being a Buddhist, it's about becoming a Buddha, your own Buddha. You know, and you've cultivated, we all have things in our life that lead to our welfare and happiness, right? And we all long for and desire welfare and happiness. All of us, all beings want that. And so we already have gotten started. Our job is just to keep going.